think about moving forward if you can, because we're finding that otherwise people are standing at the back. So if you've got a gap and you don't mind spreading out, moving forward, we can't really move forward, but spreading out rather, that would be fantastic. And while I've got the microphone, I wanted to say that we've got the prize draw in my closing remarks. I'll be doing the prize draw. So if you haven't put your business card in the bowl yet, you've still got a chance at the next break to go and pop it in the bowl on the you know, where you signed in. Okay? We'll be doing that later. Hope you've had a nice lunch break. I wanted to, it's my absolute pleasure to be introducing Anthony. I've had the pleasure of working with Anthony because he contributed to a book, but also interviewing him for Coaching at Work. And he's one of the most humble, erudite, worldly beings I know. So he's an absolute pleasure to work with, but I'm really excited to hear what he has to say in his keynote. He's an associate with Ashridge Consulting. He's an executive coach, an OD and management consultant, a social scientist. He's got 3 degrees, one of which is in financial economics. And he's one of his specialities is the leadership shadow. There's so many different underpinnings he has. I think it's going to be a very wonderful keynote. So no further ado, that one, I'm going to hand you over to Anthony. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Liz, and it's great to see a number of familiar faces as well, but I'm delighted to be here. I'm actually delighted for 2 reasons. One, because I expected to be here, and it's always great to meet colleagues and people working together in the same way, but also because British Airways managed to cancel my flight yesterday, which is a natural thing. It happens often when you're traveling. Then getting here, you know, and being here becomes really quite delightful because you actually make it. So I think one of the key things as I was thinking about doing this was to think about what do you do after lunch, and also how do you engage and connect with people in a way that's meaningful at a time when so much is going on. And very often, as you know, you'll have worked with groups, and there's this thing you do which is about becoming present and getting into the room and asking people what they've left behind so that they can be here. I'm bringing things together. So we live in a very predictable world where we know what's going to happen next. Yeah, I know tomorrow the sun is going to rise. I'm pretty sure about that. I kind of know that this workshop is going to take place. And then, of course, you know, the bus doesn't turn up and things like that. So there are things that are incredibly predictable about the brute world we live in and incredibly unpredictable. So we've got both living together. And so looking at that, one of the things that I was aware of as I was looking at it is actually thinking that as we live and work in this kind of incredibly predictable and unpredictable world, one of the things that we find is that we live and work with people who are stretched and challenged by the circumstances they're in. And the predictability being upset from time to time can create a sense of unease and all the kinds of things that you've been talking about before and perhaps you've experienced. And at our best, we are tested and we rise to that and we do better and we're very good at it. And at our worst, or when at our most challenged, we can become fearful and even frustrated, and it can be quite challenging. But we've responded really well, I think, as a species, given all these kinds of things that turn up. And certainly, you know, when I was told that my plane had been cancelled via text message, and then within the next few minutes got another text message saying, and we booked you on something else, and could you call this number, and so on. You realize just how much one chat, you know, we're really responding really well to it, and we are working hard to connect with that. And we've adapted, we've created niches and connections that allow us to work tremendously well in this multi-connected world, yeah? And it's an exciting place. It's a place where we've harnessed technologies. We are learning to live with each other in ways that, you know, a few years ago we couldn't believe we could do. We are also learning to look after our planet better. And, you know, and we are learning to extend and create all kinds of things that are quite fascinating. And our ingenuity is tremendous. Yet all of this development doesn't come without contradiction, yeah? It doesn't come without challenge. So as we create, we can destroy. As we build, we often bury. As we connect, we complicate. And as we strive, we often overreach. There's much, much more we feel, and the more we feel and the more we connect with each other, the more we are stimulated and become really engaged and feel very committed in what we're doing. And the opportunity for being enthralled as well as being deeply disappointed grows. So each challenge can bring joy and disappointment, and the more complex and uncertain the environment that we have, the greater and more numerous the contradictions that we have to live with. Yeah. And that's very much true, I think, of lots of people all over the world, to one extent or another. Hence, much of our hankering for simplicity within the complexity. Yet complexity is nothing new. Yeah. It's not something that's just turned up yesterday. It's always been with us. We feel challenge. And challenge is also a matter of perspective. You could say that actually, well, if embraced with awareness and with openness and resourcefulness, actually it is an opportunity. Contradictions that come with complexity could be less the confusing, frightening things. They could be those portions, yeah? That actually, as it were, that elixir that stimulates and brings possibility, and by giving you something that's rather unusual, you suddenly discover something new. So for confusion, we can find insight, and from that insight, actually, we can really live much, much more healthy and more connected lives. We can be more alive, we develop resilience. And so complexity in itself is hardly necessarily the enemy. In fact, the more I know, the more I realize just how simple in one sense I am as a being and how complex I am as a being. Each stage I find out about myself, the more I get puzzled about what else there is to discover. So that sense of mystery. So today, in a very networked, over-mediated, over-stimulated world, we ask ourselves, how do we work with this uncertainty? How do we live to our fullness? And as coaches working within this, what is it that we might be called for or called towards? So I want to tell four short stories and maybe make a proposition. And I do this very advisedly. And why do I do it advisedly? I do it advisedly, because giving advice and telling people what you think is not something that works terribly well. Certainly not with adults. I sometimes say to my daughters, I wish, you know, there was a time when Daddy says so, it was good enough. So I've got reticence around that, but also I'm aware that the stories that we live by really matter. Yeah. And the stories we tell ourselves really matter. And in a sense, some of the things that we share actually help to create us. And as we create ourselves and create that narrative, it actually creates possibilities. So I'll tell some stories and we'll see where that might lead us. And this is one of my favorite poets. And that last line in particular speaks to me. We can tell stories that are real and useful, and we live stories that either give us our lives meaning or negate it with meaningless. If we change the stories we live by, quite possibly we change our lives. So, the stories. My first story is a story about identity. So connecting with the identity in the midst of complexity and diversity. Now my name is Anthony Sebiala Kitakule Kasozi. Now what a mouthful, yeah. Now Anthony is a Christian name, so that talks to something about some heritage. Kitakule is the name given to me by my grandmother, which is from an African story, which is which means that which will not grow hides in the reed. And basically it is a story about a bee, which hides in the reed because it doesn't want to escape the safety of that. And in observing me holding onto my mother's aprons, they kind of gave me that name. That Kitakule, so it's a very, yeah. But it's a meaning. Sebiala, if I go into many Bantu areas, when certainly in Uganda, immediately they locate my clan and where I come from. And Kasozi is my family father's surname. So why do I tell that story? Because those things are important in because they give me an anchor. And the anchoring and the telling and retelling of those stories to me anchors me firmly in something. Now, that is not the whole of my identity. It's developed and it has changed, and I've got lots of other anchors around, but they connect to that. But in the midst of the complexity that we face, and in the midst of being blown around and all the footsteps that we take through time, there are a few anchors that actually help me be happy to ride the waves and at the same time to feel safe enough. My second story is around contradiction. I remember as a young man going to the village, and there was a village council, and my father was actually asked to work with people around the village and the village council. And there was an issue around goats. Now, anybody who knows goats well is that they tend to eat virtually everything. Yeah. And so this particular young man had actually found that he could bring up the goats, and as a result of that was actually getting milk and meat and so on for quite a lot of people, and it had really transformed the lives of many people. And at the same time, the goats were absolutely destroying many people's crops. And so the dilemma in this council, in this conversation, was do you stop the goats or do you let them carry on, and what do you do? And one of the frustrating things for me as a young man is that they sat there and they sat there and they went away and they did nothing. And 2 months later, we came back and we had the same conversation. And it never seemed as if we were actually ever getting anywhere. And then again, and I realized that there's wisdom in not deciding. Yeah. There are times when you live with a contradiction because there's another truth that's perhaps not been articulated. That in discovering and learning about the difficulties we are facing, we become better equipped to deal with these tensions. And that actually rushing to deciding in complexity can make life actually much more challenging and difficult. I never asked my father why they did that deliberately, but with time I often would like to be able to go back to the goats. My third story is about difficult questions. So that was a contradiction one. Sorry about this. I lose track of where I am with you. My third story is about seeing difficult questions and difficult episodes as opportunities for more wholesome intimacy. Not so long ago in Uganda, there was the epidemic of HIV and AIDS was particularly bad in East Africa. And to cut a long story short, I ended up actually working in East Africa for a couple of years in Uganda, where I'd been born, but I hadn't lived for many years, nearly 10 years before that. Working with people with HIV and AIDS. Now, I was working as a manager with lots of nurses. And I remember going to seeing one of the doctors and saying to them, I don't know how you do this because people keep on, you know, being ill and you're sitting with them and dying. How do you keep on doing this? And you come back every day smiling. And they turned to me and said, you know, there's something really special about holding somebody's hand and being the person with them and sitting with them and actually just expressing your humanity with them. And for me, as a young man at the time, it was really difficult to understand. It was very difficult to understand how you can live in grief and still have a certain kind of joy about it. And that story has lived with me and it has grown with time, because now I really do recognize that there's something about sitting with the difficult questions together, feeling the pain and the contradiction as well as the joy of it. And in that intimacy, finding something wholesome, which actually this buffeting doesn't actually take you away from. And my final story is really a story around working together and collaborating. And this brings us very much up to date in some senses, because it's one that's repeated and many of you engage with that a lot as well, is that from time to time we meet with coach people or we work with people who are very expert, very skilled at what they do, either in business or in the professions and so on, but are facing challenges and questions which are just problematic and are looking for the answers. How do we do this? How do we solve this problem? How do I get them to work better with this? How do we move faster? Yeah. It was yesterday, I had an example of this where right in the middle of a workshop, someone said, what we want this time is solutions, because we keep on coming back to the same question and each time we don't actually resolve it. We want some solutions. And the challenge is that very often we can't actually answer with solutions, much as we'd love to, because we're dealing with problems and dilemmas that actually can't be boiled down to one simple thing. And the more complex the environment, the more difficult it is to actually say X plus Y equals Z. You can't do that so easily. But actually that doesn't mean that we're incapacitated. Actually, if we worked together, if we lean into that which we are seeking to find, if it's conflict that is the problem and we're looking for actually more collaboration and a more peaceful environment, if we lean into that in a very practical way, we create it. And the paradox is that the more we lean into it, the more we have it, and the more we fight for it and try to actually resolve it without working together, the less we actually bring into that, we are able to achieve it. So a combination of being really assertive and saying, this really matters, we're not going to let it go. And then saying, we're going to do it together regardless of what it takes. I think that combination is a hard one to work with. We'd like it to be quicker. It doesn't always work that way. But that is a repeated story of coaching, of working with complexity, working in dilemmas, working with problems that don't have simple solutions, and accompanying people in that journey, and actually saying, in a metaphorical way, it's okay, I'm a doctor. It will be all right in the end. So what is my proposition? So this is my proposition. If we were to actually look at ways of refreshing and extending our practice, if we were to see these continually challenging times as opportunities to find new meaning, as places where we might see ourselves create and engage with each other in new beginnings in a different way. If as coaches we were to help others to live well and in a more complex world, and we were to attend to where we belong and where we find and recreate our identities each time, if we were to look at our identities as being something valuable that is passed on to us, but also something that develops and continues to develop, and each role and each job we do can enrich that. If we were to be strongly anchored, but very willing to ride the waves. If we were interested in the possibility, in that little thing that goes on in the edge, that stimulates that little small voice, and we're able to stay connected and not to fragment. If we were able to stay the course and not to run away. If we were also able to start with ourselves and actually realize that, and there's a lovely quote, I think it's from Aikido, the purpose of today's training is to destroy yesterday's learning. Something like this, I might have rephrased it. And being able to see how awesome it is that actually, having got to what I've learned today, actually, I may have to unlearn that so I might learn something else tomorrow. But that doesn't mean I lose the value of what I learned yesterday. So if we were to do that, would we be able to be more eclectic and more diverse, have greater humility and more connection, be better able to see what's going on in between us? And if we were to do that, what would it call for us as coaches? What would it call for us as our practice? How much time would we be spending in that balance between ourselves and others? And perhaps even might be even bold enough, perhaps, to express a little bit more of ourselves, let alone not just be that coach that just takes somebody along, but something that expresses some humanity while it's going along. Because we know that relationships matter, and people often report back to us that the better the relationship between me as a coach and the person I'm coaching, the more effective actually that I feel is working. We know that. We know that for ourselves. The research is showing it. And perhaps if we let ourselves express ourselves a little bit more, show our identities a little bit more, pay more attention to our practice and how that is evolving, name it a little bit more, be more bold about it, perhaps, you know, some of these complexities and the things that we work with together might be easier. Not wait for it to happen and then try and find our identity in it, but express our identities so when it happens, we know what we are connecting with and what we can lean on and what we might need to change and let go, as well as embrace. So walk barefoot, discover for yourself the path to life, to consolation. B, secure in redeeming love, knowing that through grace alone, who you are is just more than enough. Walk. Keep walking barefoot with courage and integrity, each step an inquiring scrutiny and a very firm testimony. Thank you. We have some time for questions, I believe, or some comments or anything else, or maybe just wrap up and carry on to the next session. That's fine as well. Very interesting question. I've written poetry all my life, and interestingly, what happens with me is often I have an episode, and I wake up in the morning, and there's a poem sitting in my head, and it just comes out. And then after a time, as I've learned more about what poetry ought to look like, I then may go back, and I've got a thick book. And what happens is there's a rush and then there's nothing, and then something happens and then things happen and so on. So yeah, the short answer is yes, in that it helps me express what is going on and working with. And it's something that from time to time it makes sense to engage with clients and with situations. Yeah, absolutely. And there's something about poetry, I think, that does something. Because, you see, poetry is not about thinking. It's about, you know, you feel it, and then it comes out and it expresses itself. So it starts with a disagreement or something that's just, you know, or a sense of embrace or love or whatever it is, and then it comes out and as it unfolds and so on. So it speaks in a way that I think, you know, other things cannot quite speak.
Yeah. Yeah, hold on for the microphone, it's coming.
Just over here.
You used this phrase several times, leaning into.
Yeah.
Which really, I'd like to ask you more about what do you mean by that. I made a lot of meaning from it myself. And for me, it seemed to connect very much, what I did with it, was connect with what I think about as my purpose in being alive.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you would expand on any of that for you.
I'll be fascinated to hear more about your experience and sense of that. For me, leaning into is, there's something about being grounded and you're having your feet firmly, as it were, in the ground. But also actually being prepared to then, as it were, lean forward and lean into that which I you know. And that kind of leaning into allows you to experience something which then enables you to kind of think, maybe I can take this step now. So there's that aspect. And at our best, I suppose, as a coach, there are times when you're coaching and you feel that you're leaning into each other. Yeah, and that boundary, actually, perhaps, or you know, you haven't lost your anchoring, so you haven't become the other, but somehow there's something that's connecting, and between that you have this insight and so on. So there's that aspect of it, but there's also the aspect of leaning into that which you'd like to create. Now, I'm one of those people who actually can be very cautious. Yeah, very cautious. And I do know that at my best, I experience different things if I'm prepared to lean into them. Yeah. To the extent that now my wife doesn't ask me whether I'd like to do something. She says, let's go, and then once you get there, you'll be fine. And I get excited when I'm there. Yeah. So that's how I explore. In some ways, I would be very happy in the corner there, and that's one of the challenges, is that you almost have to kind of take that step, lean into it, and actually find, oh, gosh, it's fun, it's interesting, it's different, it's okay, you know, oh, I'm not happy about this, and yeah.
You talked about anchoring, and you talked about your anchor, your name. Can you tell us a bit more about the other anchor that's kind of intertwined to make it a kind of golden thread?
The other anchors?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Yeah, that's a good question. I, as a student of economics, one of the challenging things I had was that I was brought up at first in a tradition of economics, which basically saw individual as being a rather discombobulated entity that is distinct and that maximizes advantage, or marginal advantage, and so on. So, a calculating individual that looks at possibilities and so on. The more I actually thought about how do you think of an individual in a society that's capitalist and working in an economic way and bring together the things that, in fact, I care about and social aspects and so on, I realized that we often talk about people and our identities in particular ways, but they're more complicated than that. So part of the anchoring is that rediscovering, of course, those stories that you're told about, but actually being clear about those stories that mean a lot. And much of that comes, actually, if you look at anthropologically, through the key events in our lives, and the rituals that go with that. And I think rediscovering that sense of ritual in our modern world is really quite important because it creates anchors. So birth, death, of course, and other things that happen in between are real things that create anchors. And celebrating and noting those actually create anchors. So interestingly, one of the key anchors for me, of course, I think is family. But there's family that I kind of left behind and I was brought up with, and there's family that I recreated. And then we've recreated rituals around this, and one of the rituals we have in our family is birthday breakfasts. Our children have left home, but they kind of still count the number of times they've ever missed a birthday breakfast, and why was that? And it's a ritual that actually forms a very strong anchor. And you will have anchors like, and at the time, we didn't realize how much of an anchor we were creating, but it's actually very important. And with clients as well, you find that you create rituals that then may be anchors in relationships you have. And I think that whole thing about understanding the role of ritual, how that connects to the anchoring, and how that helps with identity. And in the buffeting, it gives meaning and connections, and that you carry around. So some of them are, of course, I talked about, my name and what I'm named. The other one is family. There's a third one, which is actually around belief. Yeah. But actually, for me, belief is really something that takes place between people. So these aspects about what we believe together and what we value together. And so there's some tenets that are important for me there. But those are anchors which, at times of being blown around, they just come up. And often they come up through poetry as well. This thing about walking, for example, is a really important anchor for me, is if I lose myself, I take my shoes off. And the ritual of taking shoes off is really quite an interesting one, because I asked economic students when I used to teach them, when was the last time your bare feet touched the ground? Now, in many Western countries and universities, guess how many people there are there? Not many. Yeah. But actually feeling the ground and feeling what is going on is a real sensory and a really important thing. And respecting the ground you're walking on and that whole thing. Yeah. Farmers know whether it's dry or wet or whatever, depending on how it feels. The smell of the earth is, so reconnecting with that. So that ritual of actually connecting with that. If you have a favorite place, a favorite smell, a place that has meaning, that connects you with other things that are not about, that are not so transient and rushing around. Those kinds of things are real anchors, yeah. So those are the kinds of things, really. Yeah, we've got about 10 minutes, so maybe a few. And please feel free to share your own reflections as well.
Yeah. Thank you. Kind of, you've inspired me to. Well, I usually don't need. So thank you again, Anthony, for the poetry. As you know, we've both contributed to Liz's book, and I started with a poem, and I didn't know we had that in common. So I'm really inspired by that. And the second point is that you've inspired me to think of something in the moment. So it's not really clearly thought through. But it's something that Hetty also mentioned this morning, which was around thinking about, often there's an argument that coaching and counselling therapy are different because coaching's just short term, and that's it, you know, we have six sessions and, you know. But I think in terms of this kind of VUCA world, and you talked about anchors, yeah. I have clients who come to me every kind of 3 months, and I've been working with them for a long period of time. And one describes it as her opportunity to tune her violin.
Yeah, okay, very nice.
And it's around, she just literally wants that space. Mm. She works in the NHS as a junior doctor, and just that opportunity to anchor herself. Yeah. She uses that kind of metaphor of rebalancing and, you know, and the lovely idea of retuning her violin.
Yeah.
She doesn't play a violin. It's just a metaphor she uses.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm wondering if it's something about the next generation of coaches and coaching is around we're providing those kinds of anchors. It's a new way of thinking about the future of coaching.
Yeah, and working. Yeah, it's a lovely metaphor. And actually, the idea of tuning violins, because if you think about musicians, and there may be some in the room, and the relationship between the musician and the teacher, or the musician and the conductor, and whatever, it's a very interesting relationship because some of it is about practice, but some of it is coming from the practice and then being with somebody else and being able to play different things and try different things. And actually say, this is how this one went and how was that? But actually the person that you're working with, and some often music teachers and conductors are the most strong-willed and most opinionated, in a sense, people, because you know they have a way of thinking about how that is. But they make that work, and they make it work really well. So and coaching, counselling, it's a difficult one, that one. You know, I kind of, it's a... I tend to be, having come from a different door, I found so many things that are interesting, and I think it's important to learn it well if it's an important area and a discipline, but I wouldn't be personally not too concerned about drawing some of those boundaries, but I need to know where the boundaries are so I don't overstep it. Yeah. Oh, goodness, I don't...
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Anthony, it's been really inspiring actually hearing you speak. I live in Dubai and I work in Africa with the World Bank. I coach people.
Yeah.
And they detest sometimes that we've only got 10 hours or 5 hours of coaching allotted because they want to have dinner, they want to have lunch, they want to have this connection.
Yeah.
So I've been coaching people in Sudan and in Nepal where it's almost heresy to say, oh, we only have 1 hour together, then I'll see you in another month. And I coach Arabs too, Emiratis and Qataris, and it's the same thing. They want this trust.
Yeah.
And it takes months.
Yeah.
Then after maybe a year, they'll ask for more coaching, or they'll fight for more coaching, because they've finally realized you've taken them to a deeper place, and they trust you. And the initial goals of the coaching are kind of forgotten and seem trivial.
Yeah.
Because they've kind of gone to a new place in terms of being a leader or something.
Yeah.
So I wonder whether the growth of coaching today in the West, with multinationals saying, we give 10 hours of coaching, or typically 8 or 12 or something over a year, I think that's moving against what you're proposing. I think almost the commoditization of coaching is making it harder for us to earn a living and to do what you're suggesting.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I've got a lot of empathy for what you're saying. And certainly, we've got about 5 minutes. And certainly in the environment that you're talking about, I remember doing about 10, 12 years ago, an action learning group for some people in part of that setup. And we used to meet in one member of the action learning group would host it, and we'd meet there around the world. Now, it costs an arm and a leg to get people there. But we'd often meet the day before. We'd have dinner, we'd talk, we'd have an action learning group the whole of the day, and sometimes we'd stay on. Sometimes we'd have to pay for bits of it ourselves. 15 years later, that action learning group is still going. Yeah. And they've developed their sophistication. Occasionally, they'll invite me in, but they can self-facilitate. They've moved on to different levels of seniority. The benefit to the organization has been tremendous, absolutely tremendous. And as you know, working in that complex environment where you can't get this right, there's a political element, there's the investment element, and you're often on your own handling it, is absolutely essential. So my own view to that is, I, with respect, often subvert it because it's the only way that I can work. So, if it is an hour, it is an hour, but I try and stay connected in between. If I can go beforehand and have dinner and work with you, I'll do that. I'll invest my time and energy in that. It costs me. It really does, in pennies.
I do the same thing. Organizations think it's really odd. It's criticizing me, saying that you're the odd coach who spends too long coaching for that 1 hour.
Yeah, and of course, you know, one can develop dependency and all kinds of things that are inappropriate. But I think that is part of the reasons why we are professionals. We make that judgment. We make that, you know. And we've got work to do. I don't have an easy solution, answer to that. But I think, as you know, coaching has kind of matured and people have got you understand now. I think there's a next level of maturity that's going to have to develop. And part of our role, I think, is to educate them. Some of my clients now actually encourage me to do that because they'll retain me on an ongoing basis, make sure that we have good connections. But actually, with that guarantee of that retention, I can then, as long as I don't become too part of a system, I can then manage that. But I think there's a level of maturity that we need to get to. And certainly when you talk about different cultures, it's entirely, you know, it's just inconceivable that you walk in and in an hour you suddenly find the depth of conversation that you need. It's just not gonna happen. Okay, possibly one more and then we are done, yeah? Is that the one? Oh. Over here, thanks.
Thank you. Your speech completely resonated with me. I thought it was fantastic. Thank you for explaining, putting into words some of the things I've been thinking about. What I'm interested in is the use of creative imagination in this process. And I know you've said a little bit about it, but my sense of when you hold that dilemma, holding both the right and the wrong in the same space, what something very interesting often emerges.
Yeah.
And for, you know, I've tried to identify it as the creative imagination, and I'm just interested on what your thoughts might be.
It is absolutely fascinating because, in a sense, a lot of that is what the impulse of the artist. And the impulse of the artist is to feel these things that just don't fit together and then want to, and brings that creativity. But there's another aspect of it, which is the idea of complementarity, and that is much, much bigger, I think, in social science in Europe than it is in the UK. But actually having these two different things there, and instead of actually saying this or that, or even saying this complements that, but actually saying that, you know, this has equal validity to that, but not at the same time. And what we need to do is find out how do we increasingly bring them into the same space. And as we bring them in the same space, we then find something which is actually even, you know, and how do you hold them in the same space where actually when you bring them in the same space, they fight and they really, you know, how do you do that? Yeah, and in very practical ways, I think part of it is actually being prepared to actually embrace that which must, and this is what artists often make us do, we might feel most distrustful of, that actually we might feel most disgusted by. And by embracing, and I'm not saying talking about perversion here in any sense, but I'm talking about some of the things that I've learned over many years as being not acceptable, you know, which actually are perfectly okay. Yeah, like for me, being brought up in a boarding school, every time I walk across neatly cut grass, I expect somebody to shout, "Hey boy, get off," you know? You know? And then in walking across that grass, I suddenly find a new joy and a new discovery, but it just doesn't feel okay, you know? I have to bring it together and hold it there long enough to find something else, yeah. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Before we go, there's just, I happen to have been given a book which I hadn't read for a long time, and I happen to, you know, every now and then when I'm going somewhere, I pick up a book and I take it with me, and I think, or maybe I look at it. And for some reason, it's a way, strange way these things happen. Things happen together, and the one that I picked up before I went on my last trip is this one, Perspective, The Calm Within the Storm. And is a fascinating, you know, and actually many of the things that, as I was rereading it, many of the things we're talking about, we're working with, actually come, you know, I think I've had it off for 6 months, and why did I pick it up at this point? Anyway, thank you very much.
Well, I have nothing to say to any of that apart from I'm feeling incredibly inspired and reflective, and I hope you all are too. So just a small token of appreciation, Anthony. Thank you very much. So just to remind you where you're going, if you're going to Eve Turner's session, Eve, Janice Donaldson and Peter Smith, that's in the Booker Room, which is next door. The session on gender with Nicole Berg is upstairs, a diploma. So wind your way back up the stairs, or up the stairs. And if you're going to Joy Harcup session, it's in the Turner suite. Okay, thanks again, Anthony. Wonderful.